Chapter 6. The Burr Conspiracy. Your talents and acquirements seem to have destined you for something more than vegetable life. It would seem there has been, without explanation, a sort of consent between our minds. Aaron Burr to Harmon Blennerhassett, April 15, 1806. 1. Any thought that Blennerhassett Island could suddenly figure as the focal point of a national crisis, or that the affluent, rather odd owner of the island would be at the center of the drama, would have been utterly inconceivable to those who made Marietta their home and way of life, or that the arrival on the scene of one single public figure would set it all off. The first appearance of Colonel Aaron Burr and his means of travel were not to be forgotten. He arrived on board as luxurious a flatboat as yet seen on the Ohio River, a floating house, as he liked to say, built to his specifications at Pittsburgh. It was 60 feet in length, 14 feet wide, flat-bottomed, squared off, roofed from stem to stern, and included a dining room, kitchen with fireplace, 2 bedrooms, and windows of glass. A slender stairway led to the rooftop, which served as a promenade, where one might enjoy the passing river scenery or evening air. That a craft so large should carry a man quite so small made the spectacle all the more memorable. The date was May 5, 1805. Less than a year earlier, on the morning of July 11, 1804, Aaron Burr had shot and killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel, and it had been only a matter of months since he ceased to be vice president, all of which was well known in Marietta. He was denounced as a murderer and, by all conventional rules, a ruined politician. He, however, did not see it that way. He had come west to explore some new and mysterious pursuits, and as Hamilton himself had once said, he was bold enough to think no enterprise too hazardous, and sanguine enough to think none too difficult. Though he stood only about 5 feet 6 inches, and at age 49 was going bald, Aaron Burr, still trim and handsome, with luminous, almost hypnotic hazel eyes, had a way of charming nearly everyone, male or female. As his first biographer, James Parton, would write, "He succeeded best with young men and with unsophisticated elderly gentlemen. Many young men loved him almost with the love of woman and made him their model and succeeded in copying his virtues and his faults. He, on his part, succeeded in so imprinting his own character on theirs that their career in life was like his, glorious at the beginning, disastrous if not disgraceful at the close." Both Hamilton and Jefferson had called him the Catiline of America, referring to the unprincipled ancient Roman notorious for scheming against the Republic. His lineage was highly distinguished. His grandfather on his mother's side was the great New England divine Jonathan Edwards. His father, Aaron Burr, a scholar and theologian, was the president of the College of New Jersey at Princeton. Burr himself had graduated with distinction from Princeton when he was only 16. He served as an officer in the Revolution, married, took up the law and New York politics, and succeeded in both rapidly and conspicuously. In the words of a satiric poem of the time, "Though small his stature, yet his well-known name shines with full splendor on the rolls of fame." Ultimately, running as a Republican, or Democrat, against Thomas Jefferson, he wound up tying with Jefferson in the 1800 presidential race against John Adams, and by a painfully drawn-out decision by the House of Representatives, became vice president. In the meantime, his most trusted political ally, his wife, Theodosia, had died. What exactly his intentions were on his expedition west was hard to say. since he left a number of different impressions wherever he went, depending on whom he was talking to. To some, he implied he had come primarily to learn as much as he could about the Western country to determine his next undertaking. To others, it seemed he wanted to stake out a new settlement farther south down the Mississippi. Then there were hints and rumors of founding a vast empire in the provinces of Mexico, and there were discussions, too, about the probability of a separation of the Western states from the Union. But again, it depended on with whom he was conversing. According to one observer, when Burr spoke, it was with such animation, with such apparent frankness and negligence, as would induce a person to believe he was a man of guiltless and ingenuous heart. Burr also implied secrets and high, even risky adventure to come. There was no human being, the same observer continued, more mysterious and inscrutable. Rumors and fearful speculation about a Burr conspiracy kept growing. The impression among many was that he hoped for hostilities between the United States and Spain along the Louisiana-Mexico border to detach New Orleans from the United States and establish a new independent country. "How long will it be," asked an editorial in Philadelphia's United States Gazette, "before we hear of Colonel Burr being at the head of a revolutionary party on the western waters? How soon will Colonel Burr engage in the reduction of Mexico?" On landing at Marietta, he made a visit to the ancient mound, which seems to have interested him greatly, as did the Marietta shipyards. Much the most important stop followed when the little colonel stepped ashore on Blennerhassett Island on the balmy evening of May 5th. With him was a single traveling companion named Gabriel Shaw, a wealthy New York law client. As someone who happened also to be deeply in debt and in need of all the financial support possible for his grandiose schemes, whatever they might be, Burr already knew something about the Blennerhassetts and their wealth. On seeing their castle in the wilderness and the way of life there, he had no doubt he had come to the right place. Many there were in Marietta, however, and especially among the veterans of the Revolution, who looked on Burr with considerable suspicion, if not utter contempt, as the murderer of Hamilton, one of the heroes of the war, as well as a major stockholder in the Ohio Company. To those like Rufus Putnam and Ebenezer Sproat, as later said, Burr's arrival at Blennerhassett was an evil hour in which he, like Satan in the Eden of old, visited this earthly paradise only to deceive and destroy. The one surviving eyewitness account of the visit was written long afterward by the Blennerhassett's son, Harmon Jr., a small boy at the time. Burr was received with the usual hospitality of the island, he wrote, and his father in particular was much taken with the accomplished manners and agreeable wit and conversation of the ex-vice president. When, at about 11 o'clock, Burr and Shaw were invited to spend the night, they politely declined, saying they preferred to sleep on the boat. The Blennerhassetts then walked them to the boat. On approaching the mooring, Burr slipped on the sandbank and fell. He immediately recovered himself, it is said, though not without observing, "That's an ill omen." The morning after, he cast off downstream, heading away on his mysterious mission. What all had been discussed, or learned, or revealed to his hosts during the course of conversation the evening before, no one ever said. But the months following gave rise to considerable correspondence between Burr and Harmon Blennerhassett, in which Burr, in one beguiling letter, expressed the view that Blennerhassett deserved a more active, engaged life than the one he was leading, surrounded only with comforts and pleasures, all a merely passive existence. "Far better," Burr said, "that someone of such marked intelligence and talent as he get action, take part in the world, particularly for a man with a growing family and a gradually diminishing fortune. It appears also that at some point the evening before, Burr had put forth to Blennerhassett the prospect of a takeover of Mexico with Burr as the emperor and Blennerhassett as his ambassador to Great Britain. The ever-gullible Blanny had been taken as never before, and the result was all Burr could have desired. In a long letter to Burr, dated December 21, 1805, Blennerhassett declared himself ready to pursue a full change in life. "I hope, sir, you will not regard it indelicate in me to observe to you how highly I should be honored in being associated with you in any contemplated enterprise you would permit me to participate in." With mail as slow as it was, and with Burr ever on the move, he did not respond for more than 3 months. But in a letter from Washington, dated April 15, 1806, he expressed his utmost pleasure in learning that Blennerhassett was to return to the real world. He congratulated him for giving up his vegetable life for one of activity. "Your talents and acquirements seem to have destined you for something more." But as much still depended on certain contingencies, Burr said, the business at hand could not be explained by letter and must be deferred until private discussion was possible. On August 27, 1806, almost a year from his first visit, Aaron Burr reappeared at Marietta and made a contract with Dudley Woodbridge, Jr., for the building of 15 large flatboats capable of transporting 500 men, the recruits to be gathered for his mysterious expedition southward down the Ohio and Mississippi. As Woodbridge would later testify in court, "I immediately made a contract with Colonel Barker to build the boats." Contracts were made as well for large supplies of provisions to the amount of $2,000, and Harmon Blennerhassett was to cover the cost, boats and all. Of the boats to be built, one for him and his family was to have separate rooms, a fireplace, and glass windows. All was to be ready by December 9th, rather late in the year, given the quantity of ice usually gathered on the river by then. Speculation and rumors about Burr's shenanigans increased by the day along the Ohio, and particularly as Blennerhassett Island was so clearly to be the main staging ground. As reported back in Massachusetts in the Republican Spy, letters from Marietta in Ohio state that the public mind is considerably agitated in that quarter by political intrigues, the ultimate object of which is not discerned nor comprehensible. In public statements, Burr refused still to say no more than that it was a laudable undertaking. To Dudley Woodbridge, Jr., and hence to Joseph Barker, Burr confided that his expedition had secret government approval. Only days after Burr's visit, Blennerhassett confided to a neighbor that, under the auspice of Colonel Burr, a separation of the Union was contemplated. It was that same autumn of 1806 when a gifted but as yet unknown young doctor from Massachusetts, Samuel P. Hildreth, arrived in Marietta for the first time. He was 23 years old. In time to come, he was to distinguish himself as one of the outstanding physicians in all the Northwest Territory, but also as the great chronicler of Marietta's pioneer history and of the principal figures in that history, including that of the Blennerhassetts. His first stop the afternoon of his arrival was for something to eat at a new brick tavern house at the upper end of town, kept by an elderly Englishman, John Brough. A sign over the door featured the British Lion. There, too, at a ball not long after, Hildreth had the pleasure of meeting the Blennerhassetts. What struck him particularly about the couple, he recorded in his diary, was that while the husband, who did not dance, only sat and watched, She was quite the most attractive figure and active dancer on the floor. In little time, Hildreth heard much talk and numerous opinions about Burr, the little colonel, and what he was up to with many of the young men in Marietta and the vicinity. They were being told, Hildreth learned, that no injury was intended to the United States, and that President Jefferson was not only aware of the expedition, but approved it. Later on, Hildreth was to state with absolute conviction, not one of all that number enlisted on the Ohio would have hearkened for a moment to a separation of the Western from the Eastern states. Soon, a series of astonishing articles by Harmon Blennerhassett began appearing in the Ohio Gazette and Virginia Herald, a newly established Marietta newspaper owned by the same Elijah Backus who had sold in the island. Blennerhassett chose to write under a pseudonym, The Querist. The pioneers of the frontier west of the Appalachians were being unfairly disregarded, overtaxed, and commercially exploited by the mercantile Atlantic states and the federal government, he insisted at length. The answer was Western independence, a break from the Union. The article drew much attention far beyond Marietta. That he, Burr, has formed, and that he is now employed in executing a scheme highly injurious to the interest, the tranquility, and the welfare of the U.S., we have the strongest ground to believe, read an article in the Richmond Inquirer, that had already appeared in the New York Commercial Advertiser. From information recently received, we have been induced to believe that now powerful efforts will soon be made to sever the Western states from the Union, connect them with Louisiana, and form a whole into a distinct empire with Colonel Burr at its head. Many there were, the article continued, who were needy, unprincipled, and ready at all times to embark in any desperate enterprise that holds out a prospect of accumulating a fortune. If this be the object, it is hoped that the government will be vigilant and ready to crush with a strong arm any attempt at such a nefarious measure. By November, speculations and rumors had turned to a strong sense of alarm nearly everywhere in the country, including the White House. Jefferson had been receiving anonymous warnings for nearly a year. One, dated December 1805, began, "Sir, personal friendship for you and the love of my country induce me to give you a warning about Colonel Burr's intrigues. You admit him at your table, and you held a long and private conference with him a few days ago, after dinner, at the very moment he is mediating the overthrow of your administration, and what is more, conspiring against the state. Yes, sir, his aberrations through the Western states had no other object." A sentence from Jefferson's cabinet memoranda of October 22, 1806, left no doubt of the seriousness of the Burr intrigue. During the last session of Congress, it read, "Colonel Burr, who was here, finding no hope of being employed in any department of the government, opened himself confidentially to some persons on whom he thought he could rely, on a scheme of separating the Western from the Atlantic states, and erecting the former into an independent confederacy." On November 3, 1806, Jefferson himself wrote, "Burr is unquestionably very actively engaged in the Western preparations to sever that from this part of the Union." Then came a letter to the President dated November 12 from James Wilkinson, General-in-Chief of the Armies of the United States and Governor of the Louisiana Territory. Wilkinson, a stout, hard-drinking veteran of the Revolutionary War, had, as Burr said, a propensity for intrigue. In fact, Wilkinson and Burr, for more than a year, had been conferring privately about possible plots. Now Wilkinson had chosen to turn on Burr, telling the President, "This is indeed a deep, dark, and widespread conspiracy, embracing the young and old, the Democrat and the Federalist, the native and the foreigner, the patriot of 76 and the exotic of yesterday, the opulent and the needy, the ins and the outs, and I fear it will receive strong support in New Orleans. The letter was hand-delivered to Jefferson by a Quaker merchant chosen by Wilkinson for the mission. Why Jefferson, who loathed Burr, had delayed so long in doing much of anything about the intrigues would remain a question. But now he dispatched a trusted Virginian named John Graham, a former ambassador to Spain, who understood relations between Spain and the United States, to investigate what was happening in the West. On reaching Marietta, Graham dined with Harmon Blennerhassett at a local tavern, where Blennerhassett, under the impression that Graham had come to volunteer for the expedition, talked freely with him about plans to invade Mexico and how he was busy recruiting young men who were single, without families, and how they would be armed. When Graham told Blennerhassett he was an agent for the president to stop the expedition, Blennerhassett got up and walked out the door. From Marietta, Graham rode swiftly on to Chillicothe, where he met with the governor of Ohio, Edward Tiffin, and convinced him that immediate action had to be taken against the conspiracy. On Tuesday, December 2nd, the governor went before the assembled legislature, where the lawmakers, after 2 days of secret sessions of the two houses, unanimously authorized the governor to call out the militia. But as there was still no hard evidence against Burr, the legislature also transmitted a message to the president saying, "We trust that public rumor has magnified the danger, but should the design and agitation be as destructive as represented, we have no doubt that all fears will shortly be dissipated before the indignation of our citizens." In and about Marietta, those who had taken interest in the Burr venture all but disappeared. As Samuel Hildreth was to write, "When the act of the Ohio legislature was passed to suppress all armed assemblages and take possession of boats with arms and provisions, they, almost to a man, refused to embark further in the enterprise." A 6-pound cannon was mounted on the bank of the Ohio at Marietta, and every boat heading downriver was examined. Regular sentries and guards were posted with orders to stay on duty until the river froze over and all navigation ceased. Numerous jokes were played on the militia all the while, such as setting an empty tar barrel on fire and sending it off on a raft in the dark of night. The sentries, after hailing and receiving no answer, opened fire. Then men went out to board and take possession, only to find it all a hoax. 2. Winter had arrived at Marietta, with several inches of snow, bitter winds, and ice building up on the rivers. On the morning of December 9th, an express rider from Chillicothe appeared, with orders from the governor for the local militia to take forcible possession of the 15 boats being built for Burr, and at dusk, the authorities intercepted Joseph Barker and 10 of the boats already headed down the Muskingum. The rest were seized at the Barker boatyard. What all Barker may have said or done, unfortunately, remains unknown. News of the seizure reached Blennerhassett almost immediately, as did word that a warrant was out for his arrest. On the Virginia shore, the local militia was getting ready to take over the island. Clearly, it was time for Harmon Blennerhassett to make his exit. It became, as said, a night of acute hubbub and confusion on the island, with Cajo and other slaves moving steadily back and forth in the dark from the mansion to load boats at the river's edge, where a great bonfire blazed. Fires burned, too, on the other side of the river, where the Ohio militia was camped and keeping watch. A number of Marietta merchants were on hand, settling accounts with Blennerhassett before he got away, including most notably Dudley Woodbridge, Jr. To wind up all he and Blennerhassett had to settle took fully 2 hours. Not until past midnight was all ready for Blennerhassett to push off with a flotilla of 4 boats, carrying at most only 30 men, instead of the 1,000 or more expected. Not one man from Marietta was aboard. Margaret Blennerhassett and the children were to follow after. At daybreak the next morning, Saturday, December 13th, she made a hurried trip by skiff to Marietta, hoping to persuade the Ohio authorities to release the family houseboat so she and her sons might depart. She was refused. On returning to the island, she found her home had been taken over by a horde of Virginia militia, raiding the larder and liquor supply, and noisily ransacking the house, while outside still more were tearing up fence rails to build fires and forcing slaves to cook for them or be imprisoned. In her absence, only hours before, a number of young men who had been recruited by Burr in Pittsburgh also appeared on the scene by boat and were at once arrested and held captive. Margaret angrily protested such an outrage on her property, only to be told by those in charge that as long as they were on the island, the property absolutely belonged to them. As two of the young men from Pittsburgh would recount, there appeared to us to be no kind of subordination among the men. The large room they occupied on the first floor presented a continued scene of riot and drunkenness. The furniture appeared ruined by bayonets, and one of the militia fired his rifle through the ceiling of the large hall, the bullet passing through the chamber upstairs, near where Margaret and the children were sitting. In another few days, the adventurers from Pittsburgh were tried in the mansion and acquitted for lack of evidence. On Wednesday, December 17th, Margaret and her children departed with them on their boat. Her Eden in the wilderness, now a scene of ruin, was to be hers no more. She was granted permission to take only some silver and books of her choice and a few pieces of furniture. Not for another month, traveling down the Ohio and Mississippi, was she reunited with her husband at the mouth of the Bayou Pierre, a tributary on the Mississippi north of Natchez. At the time of her departure from Blennerhassett Island, in the midst of all the excitement, the slave Cajo decided the north side of the Ohio was the place for him, and so managed to escape across the river and make his way to the home of the English gardener Peter Taylor, who lived some 20 miles away on Wolf Creek. As a free man, Cajo stayed on in Ohio, married, had children, became widely popular as a preacher, and lived until well past the age of 100. 3. On February 18th, in the village of Wakefield, on the Tom Bigbee River in the Mississippi Territory, Aaron Burr was arrested on the orders from President Jefferson. To disguise himself, Burr was unshaven and wearing a weather-stained, broad-brimmed hat and an old homespun blanket coat, with a tin cup strapped to one side, a scalping knife to the other. But it was the eyes that sparkled like diamonds that gave him away. For a month under arrest, Burr traveled by horseback through Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina to Richmond, Virginia, where he was to be tried for treason. Harmon Blennerhassett, too, was later arrested and would make the journey under arrest to Richmond with the onset of summer, leaving Margaret behind in Mississippi. Since Blennerhassett Island, part of Virginia, was considered the scene of Burr's conspiracy, Richmond had been chosen as the proper place for the trial, and there, on March 3rd, Burr was brought before Chief Justice John Marshall in the United States District Court of Virginia. Judge Marshall's first examination of the accused took place in the Eagle Tavern, but so large was the crowd that came to watch the proceedings that the sessions following were held in the Virginia Hall of Delegates, a notably stately structure designed by Jefferson, but which at the time was bare, dingy, and dirty. On June 24th, Burr was indicted for treason. A free man no longer, he was consigned at first to the vermin-infested Richmond jail. Then, out of consideration of his having been the Vice President of the United States, moved to three-room quarters on the top floor of the state prison, where guests were permitted, then moved again to a private house. When Harmon Blennerhassett arrived in Richmond on August 3rd, he, too, was confined to the three rooms at the state prison. The oppressive heat of the Virginia summer bore down heavily as the trial continued week after week. Dudley Woodbridge, Jr. was among the many to be put on the witness stand and provided a memorable observation on how the people of Marietta and the vicinity regarded Harmon Blennerhassett. "Is he esteemed a man of vigorous talents?" he was asked. "He is, and a man of literature," Woodbridge said. But it was mentioned among the people in the country that he had every kind of sense but common sense. On the last day of August, Chief Justice Marshall of the United States Supreme Court handed down a lengthy decision. An act of treason, an act of war, could not be levied without the employment and exhibition of force, he said. His intention to go to war may be proved by words, but the actual going to war is a fact which is to be proved by open deed. The overt act must be proved by witnesses. It is not proved by a single witness. It took Marshall 3 hours to read his opinion. The next morning, Tuesday, September 1st, 1807, the jury reached its verdict in 25 minutes. Burr had been acquitted due to lack of evidence. It was a landmark decision. He and Blennerhassett were both to go free. In the years that followed, Aaron Burr lived for a time in Europe, where he wrote notes to Napoleon, offering to overthrow the American government. Then returned to New York, where, after more than 20 miserable years, he died in 1836, at age 80, unrepentant to the end. The Richmond trial over, Harmon Blennerhassett returned to his wife and family in the Mississippi Territory, where, with what little money they still had, he purchased a 1,000-acre plantation. There they would remain for 10 years, during which additional children were born. Forced by ever-mounting debt, he had to sell the plantation and move the family to Montreal. The governor of the province, an old friend, had led him to believe he might attain a post on the bench. But, as would be said, misfortune having marked him for her own, soon after his arrival, his friend died, and all Blennerhassett's expectations died with him. He moved on again, this time to England and Ireland, in search of almost any kind of employment, only to fail. He and the family were saved only when an elderly unmarried sister, Avis Blennerhassett, took pity and invited them to live with her. They moved to the Isle of Guernsey off the coast of France, where the cost of living was less and the climate more beneficial. It was there Harmon Blennerhassett died in 1831 at age 65. Margaret remained at Guernsey another 7 years, until following the death of Avis, she returned to New York. She died penniless in a home for destitute Irish women. The fate of the two older sons was to be no less bleak. One died of cholera in New York. Another, an alcoholic, disappeared in the wilderness near St. Louis. In the meantime, in 1811, the dream home she and her husband so loved on Blennerhassett Island had accidentally burned to the ground.